block. Why don't
Hi, I'm Jennifer, I'm alcoholic. Okay, little mic action. A little nervous. My sobriety date is April 16th, 1989. My home group is the Jaywalkers group in Richmond, Virginia, or Bon Air, Virginia. We meet on Tuesdays and on Fridays. Tuesdays is a speaker meeting from 7:30 to 9. We have two 10-minute speakers and then a 45-50-minute speaker. And Fridays is a beginner's group from 7 to 7:45 and a closed discussion meeting from 8 to 9. First off, I want to thank Billy for asking me to come to this beautiful place. It was a gorgeous ride today. Thank Lynn for the introduction. You know, I used to hear people say that, you know, they would get up here to the podium and say that it was an honor and privilege to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. It took me a long time to believe that, you know, but today I truly believe that it's an honor and a privilege to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous and to do it anytime I'm asked. And I'm getting better because sometimes I do it when I'm not asked. but I'm here today and I'm supposed to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. You know, and I only learned the what I was like. I know it says in the big book, you know, to disclose in a general way what we used to be like. You know, what happened and what we're like now. And normally I usually open like that. And I heard a speaker not too long ago at our home group talk about, you know, when somebody comes up to the podium, they're sharing their experience. And not to be afraid to say what I'm like, what I was like, you know, what happened to me and what I'm like now. And that's what I'm going to try to do today. I'm from New York. I've been in Richmond for actually over 20 years now, about 21 years. I grew up, family of four. I was the oldest. My dad was a cop. My mother was a dancing school teacher. a lot of alcohol growing up. A lot of parties. Parents would have major parties, tents in the backyard, bands, tables, rent tables and stuff, big parties. I think the first time I took a drink, I was about 12 or 13. But based on all that party experience, I'm sure I had a sip somewhere before that. You know, I can almost guarantee I did. But I took my first drink at 13. And prior to that, you know, I grew up always feeling different. I grew up always feeling there was something wrong with me, always feeling like you knew what to do and I didn't know what to do. I don't know where that came from. I don't know what that's about, but that's how I felt right out of the gate, that there was something wrong with me, something terribly wrong with me. I couldn't figure it out, but there was something terribly wrong with me. Took my first drink at 12 or 13. I was in junior high school. It was a wide mouth Mickey's beer out on a golf course. Can't really say I had the aha feeling or it was the best thing in the world, but I knew I wanted more, you know. I can't explain it, but I knew I wanted some more. And then, you know, I can't tell you when my first real drunk was because I didn't get drunk at that time. I just know that I found the green leafy substance in junior high school along with the alcohol. And what the attraction was being able to check out, as I called it. I was able to get high or drunk, whatever. You know, because I'm only 13 years old. It was hard to get booze unless I stole from my parents, which I did on a regular basis. But I wanted that feeling of checking out, of not having a feel, of going into oblivion. And, you know, I don't know when I became a conscious... I don't know if I ever became consciously aware in the beginning that that's what I was after, but it came a point towards the end that that's what I was after, and I knew that's what I was after. But it seems like every time I drank to get drunk. It wasn't, I'm going to have a few beers. It wasn't, well, I think I'll have a beer tonight with dinner. It was never like that for me. I drank and did some drugs, some illegal substances through junior high school. In the summer between junior high school and high school, I got in trouble with the green leafy substance because, like I said, my dad was a cop. I never got away with anything. And So my parents grounded me for the entire summer, so I had to stay home, and the only way I got out of the house was like church activities. I was raised in the Catholic Church. My father was adamant about going to church every Sunday and dragging the kids along. My mother, I was told later on, went through depression and laid on the couch. I remember laying on the couch, but I don't remember her being depressed. My father's mother, I am told, was an alcoholic. I never saw her drink. When I did see her drink, she'd have one or two beers, Pabst Blue Ribbon or Schmidt's, in a tall glass on ice with a straw. But I never saw her drunk. But I hear stories about, you know, them carrying her out of bars. All I can figure is I must have been just as drunk and just in a blackout, just not aware of it. But never saw the woman drunk. But my father, for that reason, because of my grandmother, turned to the church. So I got in trouble. I go through the religion, the good girl syndrome, and I need to get out of the house. My sophomore year in high school, I was athletic growing up. I was a jock. I was very good at sports. I was a lot better at softball than I was at field hockey, but I decided to play field hockey in the fall to get out of the house. I'm inherently lazy, so I was a goalie because I couldn't fathom running up and down the field. I was like, oh, no way. That ain't happening. But a goalie sounds good, you know? I could just stand there. And that's what I did. So I played field hockey through high school, played softball through high school. And that was my out. You know, that's where I was allowed to get out of the house. You know, it almost was like, you know, my mother was at every game, just about. My father was really proud of me at that point. You know, I was the oldest. I was kind of setting the example. But I can remember being on field trips in high school and being tanked. You know, and having to go, I can remember being tanked the day they took me from junior high school to varsity. They call me in the office and I'm like, oh my God, I'm caught. You know, that's what's running through my head. And they're like, we need you to play varsity today. You think that'll be all right? I'm like, sounds good to me. You know, not even just oblivious. In high school, I was sat down by a teacher and told that I needed to learn to drink in moderation. I don't know what the incident was. I have no recollection of why she said that to me, but I can remember sitting in this woman's office and her saying, you know, you really need to start to learn how to drink in moderation. I don't know if I was a junior or a senior in high school, but most normal drinkers aren't told in high school they need to learn to drink in moderation. So I was already drinking to excess. I was, you know, it was a party for me, but it was also a great way just to get out of the house. Growing up. Time to move on to college. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was still drinking. Actually, the drinking age in New York was 18. I turned 18 while I was still in New York before I left for college and got really drunk. I was working. Guy came up to visit me at work. Got drunk on... I always drank the sweet stuff. It was Yukon Jack. Nasty. Got home, and it was my 18th birthday. It was a big party. So sat out on the front steps of my house. My mother made pina coladas. She kept giving them to me in the fluty glasses, and as she would give me one, I'd hold on to it for about maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and then it would slip through my hand. After the third glass, it wasn't, maybe she shouldn't drink anymore. They brought me out a blue plastic cup. So the glass wouldn't break. They got tired of me breaking the glasses. And that's the way it was. You know, that's the way it was. My parents drank. I drank. I was getting in a lot of trouble then. My mother owned a dancing school, like I said, and I was stealing money from her dancing school. you know, my father was starting. My father, I mean, I know I'm a parent now. God, you can see it coming a mile away. I never thought, you know. I didn't think my eyes would be glassy. I didn't know I could look like a drunk or smell like a drunk. I was in high school. I thought I was invisible, you know, or invincible. He was starting to catch up. So I was starting to have some minor consequences, starting to get in trouble. You know, that summer before I went to college, I don't know if it was that. Somewhere in there, it was just, it got real nightmare-y. You know, I just started running away from home. I would go away and not call. You know, I would just go away for days and not call. Just be gone. But so it's time to go to college, and I think that was after I went to college, but I decided to go to college, and you know, the joke for me is I went out to Indiana to a pretty nice university on a full-ride field hockey scholarship. You know, and the joke is I played to get out of the house so that, because I couldn't hang. I wanted to get high or I wanted to get drunk. It wasn't because I really enjoyed playing field hockey. It was fun. But I got to the school and I was there a weekend and these folks were paying for my education, and it was a little bit of a rude awakening because the drinking age there was 21 and I had already had like 2 months of freedom. I had a keg party and I got in trouble. I mean, right out of the gate, got in trouble for having a keg party in my room. So the coach was on to me. I was lazy. We had to run 2.5 miles to get to the practice field. They had to assign somebody to run with me because I didn't do it. Somebody had to run with me there and run with me back because I didn't want to do it. But I had to do it because they were paying my education. College was just a free reign to drink for me. I lasted 2.5 years. My last semester, one of the hardest things I ever did was go into that team and tell them I was leaving and not know why I was leaving, but just know that I knew that December before, or whenever it was, but I remember in December, that's when I started to hit things. I would get really drunk and really angry, and I would haul off on like big oak trees. For what reason, I don't know. Just I would get angry. Well, I'll show you. You know, look at me. I was running out of friends in college. I was starting to talk about people, or we'd be at a party and I'd black out. I'd say something. I would out somebody. I would do all sorts of crazy things. One time on a bet, I drank like a vase full of beer out of a keg. Then ate popcorn and Velveeta. It was not pretty later on. You know, I mean, I was just crazy. Anything to get drunk, anything to be the life of the party. See, because that's what alcohol did for me. I became the life of a party. You know, I've always been pretty outgoing, but man, give me some alcohol, and I would do anything, anything. It didn't matter. The more outrageous, the better. The more at risk, the better. It didn't matter. So, 2.5 years, I get on the phone and tell my parents I can't do this anymore, and I went home. And I live with my parents. I don't recommend that for anybody after they've had a taste of freedom, but it was kind of hard. They owned a store, and, you know, I really started playing games. I stole from their store. I would go out on dates with men, turn around and say, oh, got this phone call, have to go, and then go out to where I really wanted to be, which was with some other women. And I did this for years with my parents. Because I was only 22 when I quit. I didn't get sober until I was 27. Did it for a while with them. Lied, cheated, stole from my family. It didn't matter. My drinking, just because I left Indiana and I came home, did not change. It was, where was the next party? Where was I going to get the alcohol? And it was probably right around there that it was, how much could I get for how often? I didn't drink every night, but when I did, I got drunk. Hands down, I got drunk. Before I left school, my last semester in college, my day pretty much went, I would get up at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, pour me peppermint schnapps in a tall glass on ice with a straw, and because that's how I drank. My whole family, anytime they order a drink, make it a tall. And I would get up and I would start with that. I would go out. I would get drunk, stay out till 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. I can remember going to bed, and Joan London and David Hartman would be on Good Morning America, and I'd be going to bed, and that's how I ended my last semester. Saw my transcripts a few years back, and I basically flunked out of school because I stopped going to classes. So I go back home, and I'm with my parents, and lo and behold, I do another geographic. I'm drinking all the time. I don't know what I'm going to do for a living. I've just quit school. I feel lower than, you know, the whales in the ocean. Well, dung. I don't really know what to do. I end up in Richmond because of a relationship. I'm in Richmond, I don't really know what to do after 30 minutes of being on somebody's couch. But what amazes me, I was in Richmond a week and found somebody who drank just like I did. got high just like I did and started partying right, you know, anywhere I went, it didn't matter. I was still after the same goal. How much alcohol was I going to get? How much drugs was I going to get? How quick could I check out? You know? decided it was time to get a job in Richmond after 30 days, and I applied for the police force there because my dad did it. Why couldn't I do it? And sad part is they gave me the job. Well, not, it was sad then. It's great now, but it was sad then. So I became a city police officer down there, and still drank, you know, still drank. Towards the end, you know, can't lie, I got the mic on. like, ding, you know. I can't say that I ever drank on the job when I was actually on the job being paid by the city, but what I will say is there came times where I was not totally coherent because I was still drunk from the night before, or I was hired by somebody else to do the same thing for this, you know, for these people, and because I can remember a Christmas day, you know, out of my socks, you know. There were times where I would work at a bar, and once the bar closed, I was in. You know, shirt came off, and I was in, getting drunk. I used to love driving home after choir practice, 9 o'clock in the morning, women putting their makeup on, and I'm laughing at them because I'm wasted, out of my gourd. You know, I thought it was funny. I loved being drunk in the daytime. I don't know why, but I loved being, probably because it was earlier in the day. I don't know, but I loved being drunk in the daytime. It was the thing to do for me. after, I don't know, I kept drinking. Went through a breakup, the relationship I had come down for. I was in the middle of a breakup. Started going to counseling because of that. Ended up in counseling. The city psychologist is what it was, to try to find out. I had a lieutenant at the time who was concerned about my welfare because I was probably 30 pounds lighter than I am today. My cheekbones were all sunk in. I had hollow eyes. They were all, I mean, blacker than they are today. I mean, I looked awful. I looked absolutely awful. And he used to bring me in my office and talk, you know. He used to talk to me about his cousin of his, you know, who might have had a drinking problem or something, you know. And I'd be like, oh, I only drink 2 beers, what's the thing, you know. I mean, and what's funny is that, you know, towards the end of this relationship, I was drinking, not all the time, but when I drank, I got drunk. When I left the party, I would steal your booze in order for me to have booze at home because I was afraid I would get caught short. The person that I was with, you know, the joke was they could drink 2 beers and stop every night of the week. I could drink a beer on any given night of the week, and God only knew what was going to happen. You had to fight me for the keys to the car. You had to, you know, if we went anywhere, you had to fight me. I was drunk by dinner time. I loved to cook. One of the things I loved to do, and, you know, I cooked with alcohol all the time. You know, and I would be, by the time we sat down at the table to eat, man, I'm like this, boom, my head's getting ready to hit the table because I'm trashed. Had no regard for the law, even though it was what I did. Had no regard for authority. Had no regard for any of my friends, you know. And people used to kid me, well, you're an alcoholic. Ah, yeah, I'm that type of alcoholic. I can't drink every day, but when I do, I tie one on, don't I? You know, crazy, just crazy stuff. I was obnoxious at that time. I wanted to fight. I remember there was this other woman that I knew. She was from New York, and we'd meet up at bars or at parties, and we'd be nose to nose. Like, who was the better New Yorker in Richmond, Virginia? It was crazy. It was ludicrous. But, I like to fight. And so, you know, it was at that point I really started to hit things. I would wake up. I had blackouts. I would wake up in the middle of a blackout, and you know, we had revolvers back then. My revolver would be locked up in my handcuffs. There would be bullets strewn across the bedroom, you know. I remember this clear as day. The bullets are all over the floor. The gun is locked up in the handcuffs on top of the ironing board. I have no earthly idea where the key is. I'm like, and I got to be to work in 30 minutes. What do I do? Calling sick. Can't be there tonight. Ain't going to work. Let's get drunk. You know? I didn't know what else to do. But, you know, and the other thing, I was talking to this to a friend today, actually to a sponsee, and just, you know, she's brand new. She's been sober 6 months. I want to say 60 days, but I think 6 months. She's in the middle of her 4-step. You know, she feels like she's losing her mind. I totally, totally relate. And she's like, is it any better? Can you, you know, is it any better? And I'm like, you know what? I didn't bang my forehead up against the base of my, or the platform of my bed last night. It's a hell of a lot better. You know, I wasn't hitting my head and trying to make the noise in my head stop. Because I could never get that chatter to stop. And when I got really, really drunk and it started to really, really chatter, because at that point it wasn't working for me anymore. It was providing no relief whatsoever. And I just didn't want to be who I was. I just didn't want to be in my own skin. I would hit my head. Hit my head. To try to maybe shake something up in there, and it wouldn't. They would shut up. The voices would shut up. Put my head through a wall. My houses have always had holes in the drywall. It was my fist. I would throw something. It didn't matter, you know? Scary part is it took me a long time in sobriety to stop doing that stuff. You know, a long time in sobriety. So my last drunk really started out on a Friday. Went to a party at work. I don't know if that was the Friday or the Saturday. But I went to a party and I tried to drink all the guys under the table, which I was very proud of because I could. You know, these big, muscular, SWAT sort of police officers, and I'm just pounding beers just because I drank all the time at that point. I come home. I go to work on a Sunday morning, and I'm hungover, going with my sunglasses on, my chocolate milk, the Sunday newspaper. I'm in a specialized unit. See, because alcoholics, we're not stupid, and we can excel while we drink, and we can excel when we're not drinking. You know, so of course I've been transferred, and I'm in a specialized unit, and so I go in, and for me that meant I didn't have to listen to the radio so much, because I was out, I was doing drug work, out doing what I wanted to do, and so I go into work. It's 10 a.m. I get there, got my chocolate milk, my newspaper, my sunglasses. By noon, I'm back home because I don't want to be there. I'm too hungover. What's going to cure the hangover? Call friends. By 3 o'clock, I'm sitting in a bar drinking watermelon shooters and beer. Can't say how many I had of either. What I have been told is, what I remember is drinking, being at the pool table, leaving, running red lights in the car, and I end up at the ex's house. What I was told 3 days later was I went after somebody with a pool cue or pool stick, threw the pool the cue ball or something like that, and punched a really good, one of my best friends at work punched her. She had a big old black eye 3 days later when she told me. I don't remember any of that part at the bar, but I understand it was really ugly. So I run red lights because I had gotten on the phone at this point, threatened to kill everybody. I get to the house. I'm in my Chevette, and I'm taking my Chevette, and I'm just ramming it into her Chevette. Because, you know, I'm going to show you. She reaches into the car. I bite her arm. Next thing I know, my department's throwing me up against the police car. You know, and now at that point, I need to save face. That's what it's all about. You know, it's like, uh-oh. You know, the red light goes off. Ding, ding, ding. Might be in a little trouble here. Uh-oh. But, you know, need to switch personalities or switch faces at this point. You know? Because even though I was that drunk, I was very conscious of what I was doing, you know, and I didn't understand why. I had no earthly idea why I didn't, you know, when I picked up a drink, I never knew when I was going to stop and why I would behave in this manner. I had no earthly idea why. I know why today, but I didn't know why then. They end up calling my partner, and they let me go home. She takes me to the house. We realize when we get to my house, I don't have the keys to my house because they're with my car. We come back into the city. She calls the department. You know, we need her keys. We're at the 7-Eleven at the city line. And this was key for me when I first got sober. I walked into the 7-Eleven, and she had to fight me because I wanted to buy a beer because it was 11:45, and I knew I didn't have any alcohol at home. And that was my concern. And she was like, I really don't think you need to have a beer. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you don't understand. Lo and behold, I come to find out, her husband husband used to work on my car, my little Chevette. And I used to go to their house on Sunday morning. And I'd walk out the door with my beer in my hand. My neighbor would be washing his truck on a Sunday morning. I'd be like, what's wrong with this picture? Why is he washing his truck 10 a.m. on a Sunday morning? Not why do I have a beer in my hand. Because at this point, I always have a beer in my hand. Never went anywhere without a beer in my hand. She, you know, don't do that, don't do that. Lo and behold, her husband's been sober like 10, 15 years at that point. Never once said anything to me. Never once questioned. And maybe he did and I just never heard him. I don't recall him ever saying a word to me. But I knew he was sober when he handed me that Living Sober book, and I about like lost my teeth, and you know, I was like, oh my God, who's sober, you know? Because I'm brand new, I'm maybe 2 weeks at this point, and this guy hands me this book, I was floored. Never had any idea. But so we get to the and in between there, when we had to make the phone call for the keys, and this only came back to me maybe 9 months, a year ago at the most. I remember being in my neighbor's house just making a complete ass out of myself. Just made a complete ass out of myself, just drunk out of my gourd about the keys and laughing like it was funny, you know, which is sad, really sad to look at it today. But we get back home, she leaves, I'm in the house all by myself, I decide that I need to get back on the phone and threaten to kill these people one more time, because I'll show them. And I pick up my revolver, and what I remember is my revolver being here because I'm threatening to kill myself. Whether I really wanted to kill myself at that point, I don't have any earthly idea. But for whatever reason, I didn't. Because I remember the gun being here. The next thing I remember is the gun being here, and I shot 3 times into on my floor of my house. And the county comes and surrounds my house. Some poor police officer sprains his ankle in my backyard. You know, they call me and say, can you please place your gun belt out on the front steps? Because I was crazy. I was literally crazy. I was insane at that point. You know, I knew I was in trouble. Hands down, I knew I was in trouble. So people show up at my house. Police department shows up at my house. The county police department, the police department I work at shows up because that's what they do. And that's what we do. You know, internal affairs shows up. And I remember at some point, you know, all these people are sitting on my couch watching. It was a Texas A&M baseball game. College baseball game. I'm still, you know, I'm like instantly sober when the gun goes off and I realize how much trouble I'm in. You know, it's like instant sobriety. Whoop, I'm sober now. I'm not drunk anymore. You know, and I remember looking at these guys going, this is like surreal. You know, it was like really surreal at that point. You know, they're watching the baseball game on my sofa. At some point they brought me into the kitchen and I remember this, sitting there, and they left me alone in the kitchen. The gun's there, the bullets are there, the gun belt's there, and I was like, man, they're stupid. You know, that's what I'm thinking to myself. Man, they're stupid. You know, it was a great learning tool later on when I ended up in the same position as these folks coming into my house, the internal affairs people. But at the time, I was like, God, I could off them all. Thank God, you know, a higher power stopped me. Because that is the only, you know, because I think of my own will, I was capable of anything. You know, anything. So they leave the house like at 5 a.m. I got to be in the work at 8:30 or 8 o'clock, some ungodly hour. I go in. They end up sending me to a city psychologist, and the same city psychologist that I've been seeing, and I say this sentence to him, because he's like, do you really want to kill yourself? I've been seeing him for 3 months. He knows I don't want to die. But I never once brought up alcohol the whole time I was in there, never once. So I say to him, you know, I really need to find a hobby. Everything I do, I have a beer in my hand. Thank God he was listening. Thank God he was listening. So that was like on a Wednesday. By Friday, they tried to get me into a treatment center. It just didn't work. And the woman that was doing my intake at the time had been sober like 8 or 9 years. And thank God for it, because she took me to my first AA meeting. You know, and I went that first week without taking a drink. I got a dog. But I didn't take a drink. You know, but I really, when I first started going to meetings, you know, it was like, okay, I didn't drink for a week all by myself, you know. But when she asked me that if I was going to go into treatment, it was somewhere out here in Charlottesville in the Blue Ridge Mountains, the old treatment center that you said, I can't remember the name of it. You know, when she said to me, well, you might have to drink a six-pack in order to get to be let in because you hadn't had a drink all week, man, sweat started pouring. I got terrified. Absolutely terrified, because I knew at that point I knew that when I picked up a drink, I had no earthly idea what was going to happen. Had no idea what was going to happen. And was scared. Was absolutely terrified. So we ended up going to an AA meeting that night. It was a Friday night. We went to a Greenwood commuters meeting when it was over on Forest Avenue. Beautiful church in the basement. And I remember walking in and the window shades were on the wall. And I didn't really think anything of it. The woman in front of me had been drinking. I do remember that. I remember having a conscious thought of, well, they're all drinking cigarettes and drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. You know, what's the difference? And they started the meeting, and the gentleman stood up or opened up. Some man decided to open up with the topic. Whew, a little tongue-tied there. And he talked about gratitude. He had been sober a year that day. And he talked about it was the first time he had seen his 9-year-old daughter in a year. And it was because he hadn't been drinking and how different his life was. And I don't know what that man said, but I knew I was home. I knew this was I belonged in these rooms. I knew it. You know, and I knew then that I was an alcoholic. I might not have wanted to believe it until 9 months later, but I knew. So when they decided to do the chips, because we do chips in Richmond, you know, I didn't pick up a white chip the first time around because I didn't know what that was all about. And the second time, this guy, Kevin, asked anybody else, want to pick up a white chip, you know, second time, whatever. And I picked it up. And as I walked by this guy, Freeman, who I've seen like once since I've done this, and, you know, when he shook my hand and said, congratulations. You know, ain't nobody said congratulations to me in a really long time. I had no, you know, I didn't understand. So, when I had been with this woman doing the intake stuff, she had set up for me to go to a meeting on Sunday. This was a Friday. She had already set up with a counselor woman that was in the program to go to a meeting on Sunday. So I knew I was going on Sunday. Well, that was a Friday night. Well, Saturday, my sister came over and this other friend of mine came over, who turns out was like, I don't know, had been to a treatment center for cocaine or something. And, you know, my brother-in-law was there all day, and he was drinking, and I was okay with that. But she decided to take me to a meeting. We went to a Midtown, Saturday night Midtown, I think it was Midtown something, on Saturday night in Richmond. And I remember some guy there talking about cutting his grass. And, you know, it's amazing what I remember. And I don't know why I kept going back, but I kept going back to meetings. And I went that Sunday, you know, and I heard things like 90 meetings in 90 days. And I don't know if I agree with that statement today. You know, but it probably saved my life back then, because I never made it. You know, I hear today, you don't want to tell a newcomer, and I understand this, you don't want to tell a newcomer 90 meetings in 90 days, because if they start looking at that basket, and they start thinking 90 meetings in 90 days, $90, I don't have a buck to put in the basket every week, you know, or every day. But for me, back then, what it did was, I wanted to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, because I felt like I had found an answer. I didn't know how to do it, but I had an hour of relief when I walked into a meeting. It was 1 hour of relief. They had taken my authority and powers from me at work, so I couldn't do anything but sit behind a desk. So I sat behind a desk and I read the big book. I don't know when I got my first big book. For the first 30 to 45 days of my sobriety, this woman had been an ex-police officer. And I kind of lived with her, so I would go home and feed my dog and do what I need, but I kind of hung out, because I didn't know what to do. I didn't know to brush my teeth, I didn't know how to do the laundry, I didn't know how to keep my house clean. I barely knew how to take care of the dog, you know. I barely knew how to show up at work, you know. After 30, 45 days, they gave me those powers back. I kept them for about 30 days, and I said, here, take them back, I'm not ready. Because I didn't know how to do my job. I was terrified. I was really scared then. You know, I remember riding, and it was like a country road on one of these little country roads you had us on. And there was cows in the field, you know. And I remember having this thought, oh, my God, they give me a gun. Like, you know, I was like, uh-oh, this isn't good, you know. I'm crazy. This isn't good, you know. But it was scary. You know, I lived a long time on fear in this program. I finally met a sponsor who started taking me through the big book. Not the way I'm taken through the big book today, but she did give me, she was from Texas, and she attempted to take me through the big book to the best of her ability. Now, whether or not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I know it today, was happening in Richmond back then, I don't know, it might have been. But I went through the way she asked me to go through. And I knew that I was powerless over alcohol, and I knew that my life was unmanageable back then. She had, and I still have it in my big book. You know, for step two, she had me write this list. You know, pros or what I thought God was and what I wanted God to be. You know, and we tore it up of what I thought God was and what I wanted God to be. I hung on to, and it's still in here. Step three, she had me put up little stickies. You know, remember higher power, remember HP. And when I opened up a door, to let God go through first. You know, it was little things like that. We went through a four step, and I never did a fourth column. Remember making the list for 8 and 9, didn't know anything about 6 or 7. And she moved when we got to 10. And I held on to a resentment for a really long time. Well, a lot of good things also happened in those first 12 years of my sobriety. You know, I was able to finish college. I was able to, I have a beautiful son today. You know, I bought and sold homes. I had a lot of nice stuff. I had a lot of self-knowledge. You know, went back to counseling. But at 12 years sober, I sat in a meeting wanting to die, wanting to eat my gun because I didn't know what was the matter with me. Because I had never really been taken through the steps. And I sat in a meeting, and a woman started sharing, and she started sharing about the big book. And she had 16 years sober that day, and, you know, she was sharing about the big book, and do-do-do-do-do, you know. All the answers were in the big book. I was like, wow, I need to talk to her. For some reason, I heard her. So I left the meeting, and then I went back in. I asked her for her phone number. She said that they were having a big book study at her house on Sunday nights. So I showed up on a Sunday night, and I understand my sponsor spoke here last week, but my sponsor walks in the door with another woman who I knew from way back when I had been drinking or had recently stopped drinking, and my sponsor, you know, started asking me stuff, and she wasn't my sponsor right then, but she said to me, you know, well, we meet here every Sunday night. Can you commit to that? You know, and I immediately, like, took the closed-off posture, folded my arms, crossed my legs, and sat back in the chair like, who the hell are you to talk to me? Like that, no less. And it turns out I started going every Sunday, and I started calling this woman. And it's just how, you know, I was desperate, you know? Called her as only the desperate would do. I was dying. I was dying inside. I was in the middle of untreated alcoholism and had no idea what was the matter with me. None. And so I started meeting at her house for an hour and a half every week. And we started going through this book. And we went through word for word, page by page, and we did what it said to do. When it said, you know, pray, we prayed. When it said write, we write. You know, whatever it said, and we started going through it. You know, and this time when I went through, I really had to look at, you know, I had the ability to stay sober all these years without the book. And getting down to one meeting a week, two meetings a week, one meeting every 2 weeks, two meetings every two, you know what I mean? Was I staying sober on my own? You know? And I had to look at that. Had to look at it both ways. You know? And I know today, down in the last fiber, every fiber of my being, that I'm an alcoholic. You know? And I'm an alcoholic, a real alcoholic is described in this book. You know? When I pick up, when I have one drop of alcohol, my body has some sort of reaction, and my brain goes, we need to get more. Gotta have some more. Gotta have some more. And when I put down that drink and I don't find a spiritual solution, my life gets worse. My life doesn't get better. See, my life over those 12 years didn't get better. Didn't get better because I put down the drink and went to a sporadic meeting. It got far worse. I seriously thought I was going nuts. So I looked at that for step one. For step two, you know, coming to believe was a tall order. Lack of power is my dilemma. I'm a power seeker. I'll try to find power in anything. Tried to find power in my job. Hell, they gave me power. You know, what a great job for power. You know, I realized today I don't have any, in the job or not in the job. You know, I've got to find a power greater than myself. You know, tried to find power in money. Tried to find power in buying things. Tried to find power in having a son. Well, if I have a baby, they can never leave me. Sick. Sick stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, if I just get this degree, I'll be okay. If I just get this promotion, I'll be okay. None of that worked. I had to find a higher power. I don't know how I found that higher power. I can't tell you. I have no earthly idea. But when it came time to do step three, you know, we went to her bedroom and we got on our knees and we recited the third step prayer out of the big book. Kind of bizarre, you know. Had to set everything aside, what I thought I knew. Because I thought I knew it all. I thought self-knowledge was it. And I knew nothing. I knew absolutely nothing about the program, about what the circle and the triangle and the three legacies, none of that stuff. You know, I thought that if I just went to a meeting and I got my hour relief, it was okay. You know, had no idea, was totally ignorant that today I go to meetings to give, not to take. And I go to meetings for the newcomer. And thank God the meetings are still here, and thank God the meetings were here when I got here. You know, and that I got to carry that on. Because if I don't carry that on, who's going to be here when my kid needs them? Because I already know my kid needs them. At 9 years old, man, I can see it. I'm like, whoo, scary. It'll be all right. But the boy's never seen me drunk, and he's being raised. You know, it's funny, I think about Hillary Clinton's book, and this is so an outside issue, but I think about her book, and, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. And, you know, and my friends laugh at me because I'm all about it takes AA to raise my kid. And everybody in my home group is raising my kid, you know. So we get to step four, and it's time to do step four, and I was terrified, and I had to go back, and it wasn't until I had to do several of them. I felt like I was in inventory forever, you know, but it was a lot of stuff. I mean, it was old stuff, new stuff. 12 years of sobriety is a lot of resentment to build up there. So I went through that, and had to redo it, and read it to her. My life has taken a complete 180 since I've done all this. But then it was 6 and 7. And I can tell you that it hasn't been since, you know, the smallest little paragraphs in that book. But the last two times that I've done 6 and 7, something happens. And I don't know what happens, but something happened. You know, and it was the first time that I fully understand, you know, that I have to become willing. And then I have to ask God. It's the only way I'm going to change. You know, if I keep doing what I'm doing and I talk the talk and I'm not willing and I'm not praying, see, because I only get a daily reprieve. And if I'm not doing the stuff that I'm supposed to be doing on a daily basis, I go right back into being nuts. And it's quick. And it's subtle. You know, it starts with me. I don't really want to call Marshall today, so I won't call Marshall. Then I don't really want to call Alex. Then I don't really want to call Janice. And then before I know it, I don't really want to call my sponsor either. You know, I don't think I'll go to this meeting tonight. You know, I go to three committed meetings, sometimes four. Maybe I'll skip this one tonight. My sponsor won't know. She doesn't go to that committed meeting. Real subtle. Little things. Just little, itty-bitty that I don't even see at times. You know, I don't even see it. Step 8 I got from my 4-step list. Step 9 I had some really good experiences with the men's. And then I had one experience that kind of, I was like, okay, what do we do with this? The good experiences is that I got to make amends to my mom and dad. I went down in October to make amends because I was taught that I make direct amends and that's face-to-face unless the person has passed away. And I've made one of the pass-away amends to my grandmother. Sat down at her grave, leaned right up against the gravestone and wrote a letter, had read the letter that I had written to her years ago. But with my mom and dad, I finally went down and I finally made a proper amends with them. This is at 13 years sober. And that was in December. In March, my mother was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Actually, she was operated on March 1st, 2005. They took a football out of her. Had I not made that amends, I would not have been able to be there that weekend for her. See, because my brothers and sisters went down to be with my mother and father. They're down in Florida. Had I not made the amends to my parents, you know, when the three of them dealt with it the way they knew how, which was go to the bar that my brother works at and have a drink in the middle of the afternoon because they don't know what to do because we're all afraid my mother's not going to make it, you know, I'm able to sit there and be with my mother and watch TV and talk and let her cry and help her, you know. If it wasn't, I wouldn't have done that. Had I done the amends. Because my mother and I had a hate relationship. I never felt any love there, and I'm sure she didn't from me either. You know, because I never knew how to be a daughter. And I never was a daughter. You know, it was what could I get from you? with them too. What could I get from them? You know, it was never what could I do for them? What could I give back to them? We have a relationship today that I never thought we would have, you know. Made amends to my brothers and sisters, and they weren't really, I mean, anything to write home about. Had to make an amends to this friend of mine in the program, and, you know, and I pray for her because she doesn't come to meetings for whatever reason. I go and I make the amends, and I don't believe you. That's what she tells me. I don't believe you. I'm like, okay, that's fine. You know, and I physically had to put my hand over my mouth to keep my mouth shut and just listen. See, because that's what I do when I make an amends. I tell them where I think I caused them harm, and that's not until after I speak to my sponsor about the harms that I've caused to make sure that I know. Because sometimes I think I've caused a harm where I haven't, or it'll cause more harm for me to talk to them, or I need some clarity, and I need to be clear about what I did. Because I'm not always, I can fluff it over, but I need to be clear about what I did, you know? So I shut my mouth and I listened. Are there any other harms that I caused? Hold my hand over my mouth, and then what could I do to make it right? Because I have to ask that question. And that's where I have to listen. I made an amends today with the woman that I live with. And, you know, consciously had to say, after I said, what can I do to make it right? And she's in this program, so she paused, like she's taught to do. And I'm like, okay, God, please help me to listen. You know, because I think my job's done there. I don't want to listen. I might hear something I don't want to have to do. You know? So, I've gone through step 9. Step 10, you know, is a daily process for me. You know, I don't always see the, I try to recognize it. The key for me with step 10 today is, though, is if I have a resentment or a fear, I get selfish or afraid, whatever, you know, not only do I need to call somebody and talk about it, but then I need to turn my thoughts to somebody else. See, and that's that little part that I'm really trying to practice today, you know, is turning my thoughts to somebody else. Because I'm selfish and self-centered. That's the root of my disease, and that's what they tell me. And if I really want to be honest with myself and I really want to look at it, oh, yeah, I am. Hands down. It's still, I still want it to be all about me at times. I'm better about it today. Step 11, I only hear recently, I used to just go through the motions off and on. Never really got on my knees. Got on my knees when I felt like my behind was falling off. When I was in dire straits. When I needed cash. When I needed something to work out in my favor. The last 2 or 3 weeks, what I did was, out of a suggestion from somebody else, I put a pillow at the end of my bed. So I would remember, it forces me to remember to kneel. Weird, but it forces me to remember to kneel. And I've been getting on my knees and doing the 11th step in the morning and the 11th step at night. And man, my life is just, I'm learning. It's been a growth process, let me tell you. You know, and I'm doing it with somebody else. We do 11 step buddies in Richmond. And I'm doing it with somebody else. And that's an eye opener. You know, that's an eye opener. You know, and I make my plans out for the day. You know, and if I have to carry them over, I carry them over. And the other thing we started to do in that process, that 11 step process in the morning when we make our plans, and I just recently heard this by Don M. from, where's Don M. from? Kentucky? I just recently heard this from him. What he does is he tries to pick one of the principles and focus on it throughout the day. See, because if I don't, my mind doesn't have something to focus on, it'll just go. It'll go places. You know? I've really had to learn how to pause. You know? Because my sponsor tells me there's a split second in there for me to pause before I start to open up my mouth. I have that split second if I'm paying attention. And it works. It actually works. But I have to do the footwork. You know, I had this conversation with two people today or yesterday or within the last 2 days, you know. The question of, do I have to invite God? You know, if I say the word, if I say God, God is present. My job is to say God. That's my job. That I, if I'm supposed to be in the, if I'm supposed to have a conscious contact with God and to keep a conscious contact, the only way I know how to do it is to say God. And if I'm offending anybody, I apologize, but that's what I say. God. You know, and then God is here. God is. God is in everything. Took me a long time to believe that. Didn't trust God for a long time. Didn't trust God because I thought God made me different from all you people. That kept me out there. Kept me out there drinking, and it kept me out of these rooms. Anything to make me different. And I used it as the excuse. And then I wore it like a badge. You know, I'm different than you. You know, or it's going to be different for me because I'm different. And it's not. It's no different. I'm a garden variety drunk, as I hear people say. You know, I'm a drunk just like you. And I only get a daily reprieve. And it's based on my spiritual condition. And I, for the life of me, never could get that. And for once, for right now, I have it. I understand that. You know, it's not my job. It's not God's job to come to me. It's my job to go to God. And every problem and everything that happens in my life is a spiritual problem. It's because I'm not connected in some form or fashion to my higher power. And if you had told me that 6 months ago, I would have told you you were out of your gourd. That not every problem... See, because I struggled at my job to trust. I don't understand why this bad stuff happens out there. It's all part of a greater plan. I'm not supposed to understand. But what I do is a spiritual thing. You know, I've got to find a higher power in what I do, in everything that I do. Because if I don't, I'm thinking about me. Because I'm going to think about me before I think about you. It's just the way I am. It's in my nature. I'm an alcoholic. Step 12, I was, it's funny, I talked to my sponsor today about this. Because I have like 5 sponsees, and I'm like, why are these people wanting to talk to me? I don't get it. You know, I didn't sponsor people until a year ago. And if I did, the 2 or 3 women I did, God help them. One of them I think is still sober, but I did them an injustice. You know, because I'm not there to be their friend. I'm not, you know, I have to work with others in order to stay sober. I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And now it's my job to carry the message. And not only is it my job to carry a message to the other alcoholics, to the women that I sponsor, but I have a home group and I have a job in the home group. I have to be of service. You know, I have to make sure you get yours before I get mine. And it works that way, hands down, every single time. If I make sure Marshall gets his, I'll be fine. I will get mine. Maybe not on my timetable, but I'll get mine. Whatever that is, that day, or, you know. And sometimes it's just, I don't have the chatter. I don't feel like I'm losing my mind. Everything's clicking, you know. I'm in that stream of life thing. I'm in that flow, in that power, you know. I spent years not being in that power, and it's not fun. Wasn't fun at all. I've had great things happen to me in sobriety. Like I said, my life is nowhere near what it was like in the time that I met my sponsor. And then now. I spent a year, I got promoted, I'm actually a lieutenant. And I spent a year on midnight shift. And I'm a single mom. How do you do that? How do you go to work? I don't have anybody to take care of my kid. And when I left, when I said, AA, raise my kid. AA, people. Watch my son when I worked at night, you know. And on the weekends, because I worked every other weekend at that time, they would keep my son all weekend long so I could catch up on sleep, you know. It's funny, I've had people come up to me the last 2 months and say, my son is so different. And I never saw it until, you know, my roommate said to me, well, he's off the charts. And I'm like, he's not off the charts. You should have seen him 3 years ago. He was really off the charts then, you know. And it's nothing but this program. You know, and all I've done is I followed what was suggested in this book. You know, I have followed what is suggested in this book. And I've had lessons here lately where I didn't follow suggestions in this book. And I thought I could do it my way. You know, I thought that I could, you know, do it my way is really what it all boils down to. And I can't still today. You know, bottom line is I've got a spiritual disease and my only solution is a spiritual solution. You know, and if I don't find a higher power, I'm screwed. You know, I just am, flat out. You know, I have sponsees, I don't trust God, I don't, you know. I'm like, set it all aside, just get through the steps. Just get through the steps. See, because I used to think that if I just went to a meeting, everything was going to be all right. Took me to where I wanted to blow my head off. It wasn't all right. You know, I gotta have. You know, I heard somebody talk about that three-legged stool. If you only got one leg or two legs, the stool's gonna fall down. It's not gonna hold you up. Had the opportunity to go to Toronto for the AA convention, the international convention. It was awesome. It was absolutely awesome. Had the opportunity to ride in a car. Well, actually, we tried to get to a funeral in Denver, and they had a spring snowstorm in Denver. We went by way of Houston, and we couldn't fly in, so we rented a van. Six women in a van from Houston to Denver, you know. Stopped in some New Mexico town. It was a feedlot town. It stunk. It had fly swatters in every room, which I thought was a joke. It was hysterical, you know. But I had one of the best times of my life, you know, with these women. And I was the one on no sleep. I was nuts because I hadn't had any sleep because I had worked. I was crazy. Marshall knows. I was absolutely nuts, you know. I have so much joy in my life, and I cannot explain it to you. And why, you know, it's a gift. You know, I didn't do anything to deserve any of this. None of it. You know, did nothing to deserve. Why I'm sober and somebody else isn't, I don't know. But I need to be grateful or I'm going to lose it. Smoked for 17 years. Quit when I got pregnant. Stayed quit for, till May of this past May. Smoked for 3 months and I've been quit again. But this time, you know, I didn't do it because I was pregnant, or I didn't do it because he doesn't want me to smoke my son. You know, I did it because I'm powerless over nicotine, just like I'm powerless over alcohol. You know, I'm powerless. My life is unmanageable, and I need a higher power. And it's the only way I know how to do it. Have I spoken long enough? Thank you again for asking me. Marshall, I forgot to thank you. Thanks for coming with me. It's always fun to have a buddy to ride with. If you're ever in Richmond, by all means, on a Friday or a Tuesday, please come visit us. You know, I won't say it's the best home group in the world, because I've been told it's just not appropriate to say, because we have a perfectly adequate home group, as Marshall reminds me, and we do, you know, and we do. And we're active, and we party like you wouldn't believe. You would think, if you were a normal person looking in on us, that we were drunk, but we're not. We just have a really good time. You know, and they're my family today. You know, I walked into the meeting Friday night, and my roommate walked in ahead of me, and she was all, you know. And I walked in, and John Pine, who I think, if y'all were here, heard him, says, "What's the matter with you?" And I was like, "Is it that obvious?" He's like, "Oh, yeah." You know, and for me today, that's what the home group is. They're my barometer, you know. They know me better than I know me at times, and they know me better than my family. With that, thanks. Can I turn this off now?